That's exactly what happened. There was massive outcry across the Arab world, including in Iraq, a rise of insurgency across the country, and a complete devastation of the city. I remember walking through the city shortly after the Marines pulled out, and there were rotting bodies all over the streets because during the actual siege, U.S. Marine snipers would shoot at anyone who is outside, so people were afraid to go and bury the dead. Shopping centers were destroyed. And this gets to an important issue of disproportionality. All this whole assault was launched because of the killing of four Blackwater security contractors. And, you know, in response,
we have to leave it there now, but we're going to continue to cover this with our web exclusive. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The evening news is next.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
The World Arts Foundation Incorporated and KBOO would like to invite you to its 32nd annual tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Monday, January the 16th, from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center located at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Invited guests will include a multitude of speakers and performances that includes the Portland Interfaith Gospel Choir and choirs from the Portland Public Schools, African drumming, and the acclaimed Jefferson Dancers, and much, much more. Monday, January the 16th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., live right here on KBOO 90.7 FM. Keep alive the dream.
The greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, even though snow has stopped falling in Portland, the winter weather continues to affect the city, especially its houseless population. We've got a list of the temporary shelters open tonight.
In Washington, D.C., hearings continue for Donald Trump's cabinet nominations, including Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense.
And following a recent racially charged incident at OHSU, we'll speak live with three people who are closely following the institution's response.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 12th, 2017. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and Oregon Governor Kate Brown have declared a state of emergency for Portland in the wake of this week's inclement weather, which is expected to continue in the Portland metro area until this weekend, with lows in the teens and daytime highs hovering around 31 degrees. The declaration allows the city to request resources from the state and possibly federal funds. Portland metropolitan daytime warming stations and evening shelters have been overflowing. In many cases, they are unable to meet the needs of those seeking refuge from the winter storms.
Four houseless people have died from hypothermia during the cold snap over the past few weeks. A number of overnight warming shelters have opened in the Portland area in addition to year-round shelters. The Portland building at 1120 Southwest 5th Avenue is able to house up to 90 people tonight. Daytime warming centers in Washington County include Just Compassion at 13270 Southwest Pacific Highway in Tigard, and Open Door Counseling at 34420 Southwest Tualatin Valley Highway in Hillsboro. Many shelters are open for limited days during the worst of the weather. While most take walk-ins, some require reservations or screening. The temporary overnight shelters are Imago Day at 1302 Southeast Ankeny, Bud Clark Commons at 650 Northwest Irving, the Portland Building at 1120 Southwest 5th Avenue, Union Gospel Mission at West Burnside and 3rd, St. John's Warming Shelter at 4775 North Lombard, the East County Building at 600 Northeast 8th Street in Gresham, Anawim Church at 19626 Northeast Gleason, American Legion Post at 134 American Legion Post 134 at 2104 Northeast Alberta, St. Francis Dining Hall at 330 Southeast 11th, and Peace Shelter 2 at 333 Southwest Park Avenue. A full list of year-round temporary and daytime warming centers is available by calling 211 or texting PDX Shelter to 898211.
In a press release today, the Independent Police Review Division of the Portland City Auditor's Office announced it is seeking a volunteer to fill a seat on the Citizen Review Committee. The CRC advises the IPR and the Police Bureau during police misconduct investigations and on other matters. CRC volunteers serve three-year terms, with the current open position beginning in March 2017. The CRC also hears appeals from community and police bureau members regarding misconduct investigations, listens to concerns and complaints from the public about police conduct, participates in trainings, and reviews bureau policies and procedures. The CRC and the city's police oversight apparatus as a whole have come under fire at the local and federal levels for perceived weakness in the face of entrenched police practice and the power of the local police union, the Portland Police Association. Applicants must be Portland citizens or business owners, and applications can be found at the IPR office in City Hall or at portlandoregon.gov/IPR. Applications are due February 8th at 5 p.m.
In a decision filed today, the Washington Supreme Court did not uphold a 2015 Court of Appeals decision to allow two companies to expand oil terminals in Grays Harbor, Washington. The court found that that the desired expansion would be subject to the Ocean Resources Management Act, which aims to protect the wildlife and waters of Washington's coast, and that the proposal therefore required further review of the potential environmental impact of the expansion in order to move forward. The Imperium Terminal Services and Westway Terminal Company were permitted to expand their oil terminals as originally proposed. It would result in a 310% increase in vessel transits, as well as a 133% increase in train transits through Grays Harbor per year. However, as the state Supreme Court ruled that these proposed expansions qualified as ocean uses and transportation, as defined by the Ocean Resources Management Act, which was passed in 1989 in response to the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska, requires that, quote, all reasonable steps must be taken to avoid and minimize adverse environmental as well as social and economic impacts in such projects.
In the wake of Donald Trump's election as U.S. president, the state of California is considering the possibility of seceding from the United States. A group of Californians have already taken the first steps towards California's secession. Ann Garrison of KPFA Berkeley reports for Pacifica.
On November 21st, California secessionists, calling themselves Yes California, filed papers with the California Secretary of State proposing a November 2018 ballot measure that would ask registered voters if California should secede from the U.S. and become its own nation. If passed, the measure would strike language from the California Constitution that says the state is an inseparable part of the United States of America and the United States Constitution is the supreme law of the land. It would also require a special election in March 2019 for the sole purpose of asking voters if they're really sure they want to secede. The measure's been dubbed Cal Exit. Its authors answer a long list of questions about how California's institutions would adapt on their website, yescalifornia.org. I spoke to David Swanson, executive director of World Beyond War, and one of the first writer activists to come out in favor of Cal Exit. David, you saw the Cal Exit coming back on March 17th when you wrote the essay, Secession, Trump, and the Avoidability of Civil War. Similar movements emerged, most visibly in California and Vermont, after George Bush's second election, but both quickly faded from media attention. Do you think this is a historical moment in which they might have more staying power?
Well, I hope so, and that's all this is, a hope and advocacy on my part. I wasn't making any accurate prediction or inaccurate prediction that a secession movement would happen. I'm just encouraging that there be one and that it grow. I think it can be a step toward actual integration with the rest of the world, because the current United States is a rogue state, violating international law in so many ways that California wouldn't have to be if it seceded and became a nation.
Yes, California, the campaign, needs 600,000 signatures or a two-thirds vote by the state legislature to put its California constitutional amendment on the ballot. The two-thirds vote in the state legislature is all but unimaginable, so that means they need an almost equally unimaginable volunteer effort. Then, if it did get on the ballot, and if it passed, two-thirds of Congress would have to vote to let California go. None of this is taking clear shape on the horizon yet, but why do you think it's worth talking about?
Well, I think almost everything important that's ever happened was unimaginable shortly before it happened. Good things and bad things. Ending slavery, ending child labor, women voting, etc. I think the current state of U.S. foreign policy with several wars simultaneous was unimaginable, still is unimaginable to most people. Climate change is so unimaginable, most Americans deny it's happening. So I think we have to work for the unimaginable, and that California, like anywhere else on Earth, should have the right to secede. That was the position of the United States government on Yugoslavia and other places around the world. Many people should have the right to leave.
You're an out-of-state supporter, doing your writing and organizing work in Charlottesville, Virginia. If California were to secede, do you imagine that the rest of the United States might then break up into smaller, less violent, and more democratic states?
I'm not that good at predictions, but I think that the status quo is not acceptable. It's absolute guaranteed disaster for the climate, for war and peace, and this has a decent chance of succeeding. It has to be carefully done right. But I think that breaking the United States up into a number of pieces could be very good for the integration of those new nations with the rest of the world and international law. And I think that it would be very good for democracy for people to be within some hundreds of miles of their nation's capital, so that you didn't have to travel thousands of miles to protest, to exercise your First Amendment rights, which is the current state of affairs in this overlarge nation. I think California as a nation, or a larger, greater West Coast nation, should other states join with California, would be a good influence on the rest of the United States. Especially if it chose to actually become a signer of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, a member of the International Criminal Court. We have to do something. And if we think that we can somehow gain control of the U.S. federal government as it now exists and bring it under popular, enlightened, progressive control and make some effort to preserve the climate and rein in the dangers of nuclear and other warfare, then we should. But if we think it's even more likable that we can succeed in those ultimate goals through secession, then we should go down that path. I don't think it's a question of personal lifestyle preference or some sort of parochial identification with your state. I think it's an absolute moral demand that something be done to create a government with some power that can be controlled by the residents of its territory.
And that was David Swanson, founder of World Beyond War. In Berkeley or Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Since the election of Donald Trump, there have been well-documented rights and racist incidents. The Southern Poverty Law Center noted 33 incidents in Oregon during the month of November alone, putting the state near the top of the list on a per capita basis. The center also pointed out that many racist incidents go unreported. Back in September of last year, Maria Frazier was with her mother and children in a car when an unknown assailant pepper sprayed them as he yelled racist epithets. The assailant was never caught. And once again, this incident has come to haunt that same woman in her own workplace. Here to join us is Matt Hilton, the president of the AFSCME, Local 358 Union Chapter, and Maria Frazier. Thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Great. Maria, can you tell our listeners what happened to you in your workplace in the days following the election of Donald Trump?
Well, before the incident, Donald Trump, me and my kids were already victim of a hate crime that we never caught the person. That was very traumatic and you know, when you can't see or breathe, or your kids can't see or breathe, and they're running to trees and screaming, and I couldn't help them, was like a bomb had just went off. But, you know, we're coping. And then after the election, going to the mailroom, there was a small handmade noose that was taped up against the wall. And I took a picture of it, and I reported it to the administrator, which he took it down. And after that, I let my main boss know what happened. And she said, oh, it wasn't there yesterday. And so then I had another meeting with some other directors, and they allowed me to go home for half of the day because I no longer felt safe. They tell me who did it eventually with the phone call, and that the person was really sorry, a physician assistant, and they talked to him, and they wanted him and us just to sit together and have him apologize to me. But I no longer felt safe and felt intimidated if I did sit with them as a group and not have anyone to support me.
Mm-hmm. And how are you doing right now in the wake of this incident?
Well, I still haven't been to work. Mm-hmm. And sad to say, OHSU just brushed it over and act like it never happened, and making it seem like that I'm overly sensitive and a noose in the workplace is just a bad joke.
Oh, wow. And were there any other responses by the OHSU administration after this incident?
No, all the support I felt like I got was actually from the union. And that's who actually stepped in and filed a grievance in my behalf, and it actually started to fight for me and not actually against me.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that this response is in line with OHSU's policies regarding exclusiveness and non-discrimination?
No, because I don't know how you can make a noose that represents lynching of someone dying and think it's funny, especially when you're supposed to save lives and not take them. So no, it's not.
And have there been any other indications of an intolerant atmosphere or behavior since this election?
Well, like I said, I just haven't been back since it happened, and I'm pretty much felt like I got thrown away. So it's just, I'm just here. I haven't been to work, and I was told to apply for a Family Leave Act to protect my job, even though they knew what happened, and I no longer felt safe or comfortable there.
Mm. And with OHSU being one of the largest employers in Portland, in your words, Matt or Maria, why is it so obviously it's important for them to set some kind of precedent, but just in your own words, like, why is it so important right now?
Sure. So I think looking at OHSU in terms of being the public institution that it is, we have one of the largest employer in Portland. OHSU has over 14,000 employees. And I think when you have an institution that's dedicated towards teaching, learning, and healing, I think we really need to talk about what sort of culture is present there, where you'd have an employee who thought it was, I mean, regardless of intent, placing a noose in a workplace, especially a teaching hospital, is beyond, I mean, it's, one, it's offensive. Two, it's wrong. And then for OHSU's response to just sort of, you know, brush this aside and keep moving ahead, like it's, I mean, clearly there's a toll to this. And I mean, as Maria tells her story, we really need to have a discussion about the sort of culture that it would exist where this incident happens. It's investigated. And then they tell Maria officially in one of their responses, we're sad that you perceive this as a racist incident, mm-hmm. which is very telling of how their actual processes are. AFSCME has been working with OHSU previously in the start of near the tail end of 2015 into 2016. We had worked with OHSU to sort of do an investigation related to the environmental service employees at OHSU. There were some very serious allegations that were made that warranted OHSU hiring a private investigator. Because a lot of the complaints had merit, they actually terminated three supervisors in that department. We've had ongoing labor management committee meetings. And I mean, this would be an example of OHSU doing the right thing. However, in Maria's case, we feel that their response was extremely inadequate. What's even more frustrating is this Friday, OHSU, in honor of Martin Luther King Day, is going to be having an event being held at their main auditorium sort of highlighting how they claim to be an inclusive, non-discriminatory employer and celebrating diversity. And it's one thing to talk the talk, which, you know, is the right thing to do. But when you're not actually walking the walk, what do those words mean really? And I think as a public employer, as one of the pillars in Portland, you very much have a responsibility to your employees, to your community. And when you handle this the way you do, what sort of message does that send to other employers? And we think they very much could have handled this differently. And this is very much an ongoing matter. We're grateful that you're having us here to have this conversation. And this is something that we want to keep having the conversation about, because this is a very serious matter.
And you may have touched on this already, but to be clear, is OHSU responding in any way to Maria's complaint at this point?
So like Maria mentioned, our union did file a grievance concerning this. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how familiar you are, your audience is familiar with labor processes. So OHSU has denied our grievance. They're not denying that the incident happened, but they're basically saying our grievance doesn't have merit. We investigated the matter. I mean, what's telling is this individual wasn't even placed on leave during the investigation. The individual is still working at OHSU. And I think what's important to note is when we talk about what a physician's assistant is, this isn't the frontline staff that would like weigh a patient or take blood pressure. A physician's assistant is a primary care provider who can write prescriptions, does hands-on care with patients. And the fact that you could have someone in this position, as a joke or not, place a noose in a workplace and then see patients, it's very telling as to how this is being handled.
Mm-hmm. And Matt, what role does the union play in incidents like this?
Well, I think what we're very much trying to do is support Maria, get her story out. We're exploring avenues with OHSU. We've gone through the grievance process. This is going to be something we'll be discussing in our executive board meeting next week. And whether or not this proceeds to arbitration, there's a variety of other options. But we very much want to see them do right by Maria.
And is there anything else either of you would like to add?
I just feel that OHSU just pretty much threw me away. And they act like it never happened.
Wow. One thing I would hope is that if there are other employees either at OHSU hearing this or other employees at other employers, speak up. I mean, the way we deal with these things is to shine light on them and have conversations, not to brush it off, suck it up, and pretend it didn't happen.
Absolutely. And, well, thanks so much for coming in. I'm very sorry to hear about this, Maria. And once again, that was Matt Hilton from the American Federation of County, State, and Municipal Employees, and Maria Frazier, an employee at OHSU. Pardon?
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be more of the same. Look outside, that's what you're going to get. Today in history, in 1932, Hattie Caraway became the first woman elected to the United States Senate, where she served as senator for the state of Arkansas until 1945. And in 1967, James Bedford became the first person to be cryogenically frozen and preserved after legal death. He remains frozen to this day. Our quote of the day comes from the American novelist Jack London, who was born on this day in 1876. Quote, "The proper function of man is to live, not to exist. I shall not waste my days in trying to prolong them. I shall use my time."
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Good news, folks. Our new president says he's planning a tax holiday for you. well, not directly for you. Trump's trillion-dollar whopper of a tax break will only go to such multinational corporations as Apple, GE, Johnson & Johnson, and Microsoft. However, Trump will push for these cuts in your name, insisting that the trickle-down effect will be to create thousands of new jobs for America's hard-hit working stiffs. Here's the deal. To dodge paying the taxes they owe to our country, many U.S.-based global giants have stashed about $2 trillion worth of their profits in offshore bank accounts. Now, they want to bring this pile of loot home. Yet they want to be rewarded for doing so by having the taxes they owe to us be slashed. Enter the Donald, who has delighted these scofflaws by offering to tax that offshore income at the low rate of only 10%. Versus the 30% you and I pay for America's upkeep. Trust me, exclaims the Donald, they'll expand their businesses here and generate jobs for you. I was born at night, but it wasn't last night. We've been suckered with this tax holiday scam before. In 2004, George W. Bush pulled it on us, and instead of creating jobs, the corporate tax dodgers actually eliminated thousands more of our jobs. Why'd that happen? Because they put their repatriated profits not into expanding business, but one, buying back their corporation's stock, which jacks up the payout to top executives and the richest shareholders, and two, shrinking the number of businesses by buying up competitors and firing duplicate workforces. This is Jim Hightower saying, the way to know whether or not Trump's tax holiday will benefit workers is to see if it requires that corporations actually create the thousands of good jobs promised before they get any tax break.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
During his confirmation hearing Thursday, retired General James Mattis faced little opposition to his nomination to the position of Secretary of Defense by President-elect Donald Trump. The Senate voted overwhelmingly to grant Mattis a waiver that exempts him from a law prohibiting military officials from serving as Defense Secretary within 7 years of serving in the military. Some Senate Democrats supported the waiver, believing that Mattis will act as a check on Trump's use of military force if he is appointed to this position. Mattis, by the way, was nicknamed Mad Dog by soldiers serving under him in the Gulf War. During the hearing, Mattis upheld that he would be forceful in expressing his views, even when they diverged with those of the incoming president. The law was originally passed due to concerns over the potential loss of civilian control over the military. The fear is that Mattis or other recently retired officers in the military would let biases and connections affect their role as Secretary of Defense.
Before President Barack Obama leaves office, Republican members of Congress have already begun the process of repealing one of the legacies of his administration. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
Is there any senator in the debate in the chamber that wishes to change their vote or vote? On this vote, the yeas are 51, the nays are 48. The concurrent resolution is agreed to.
With that, the U.S. Senate took the first step in rolling back the Affordable Care Act, the health care law through which about 20 million Americans are currently able to qualify for health insurance. Also known as Obamacare, the law blocks insurers from refusing to cover individuals with pre-existing medical conditions, allows parents to cover their children until they are 26, and requires most taxpayers to purchase an insurance policy. It also provides preventive health care at no cost to the consumer and expands Medicaid. The rollback measure was included in a Senate resolution that tied repealing significant portions of the health care law to reconciling the federal budget. The budget reconciliation process has rules unique unto itself, lending to what has become known as the Votorama, a marathon session of the Senate in which amendments can be introduced, but not debated. In a seven-hour session that spanned Wednesday night and into Thursday morning, after all amendments were shot down, the resolution itself finally came up for a vote, and Senate Democrats tried to voice their opposition.
Ms. Heitkamp.
How am I recorded?
Senator is not recorded.
On behalf of the thousands of
Senator
people who receive health care in my state
order.
And rural hospitals who know not how they're going to get health care if this
clerk will
passes
roll vote.
Without a replacement,
Senator
I vote
will
no.
Suspend.
Ms. Heitkamp, no.
The vote came after days of discord during which a handful of Republicans indicated they might not be ready to support what was being referred to as repeal and delay, which would postpone the effective date of a repeal while a replacement proposal is crafted. But with just one Republican actually crossing the aisle, Kentucky's Rand Paul, the resolution passed and the repeal effectively began. At his first press conference since the election, held just hours before the Voterama, President-elect Donald Trump made it clear he intends to put forth his own replacement plan quickly, reclaiming the repeal and replace theme he regularly employed on the campaign trail. The resolution now goes to the House of Representatives, where Speaker Paul Ryan says lawmakers are in lockstep with Trump.
So we are in complete sync, and we agree. We want to make sure that we move these things concurrently at the same time, repeal and replace. We need to show that there's a better way forward. We need to show that even though this law is collapsing, we can bridge ourselves to a much, much better system. The pillars that we stand upon with replacing Obamacare, more choices, more options, lower prices, and more control over your own health care. Those are the things that we all believe in. We're completely in sync, planning on a daily basis with the administration for how to roll all of this out, and that's what we're doing.
Ryan said a procedural vote is scheduled in the House Friday, after which individual committees will address specific means of rolling back the landmark legislation. Without a replacement proposal, it's difficult to know just how many people in the U.S. stand to lose their health insurance, but according to a recent study by the Commonwealth Fund, the number is somewhere between 17 and 25 million. Nell Abram, FSRN.
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The University of California system is one of the 10 richest universities in the country, but Teamsters Local 2010 president Jason Rabinowitz says that university workers are suffering from low wages and years without raises.
The workers are about 80% women, two-thirds people of color, and the university has driven down their real wages over the past two decades by about 24%, to the point where over 70% of the workers, according to a recent study, are suffering from either hunger or food insecurity.
Thousands of UC workers represented by the Teamsters went on a recent unfair labor practices strike, charging the university with violating state labor law by not bargaining in good faith to get labor contracts and raises done.
We have numerous charges with the state of California, with the Public Employment Relations Board. They've issued complaints against the university in several unfair practice cases. So we do hope that that helps to convince the university that they need to be fair when the state is taking action against you. And we're bringing our message to the legislature. Many of the top legislators in the state have been asking the university to get back to the table.
Rabinowitz says as striking UC workers returned to work Wednesday, some managers tried to intimidate them for their strike action.
We have some reports about some managers that have tried to threaten or scare our members, and we're going to find out more detail about that. The university did try to scare our members before the strike, tried to tell them the strike was illegal, even though, you know, if it was illegal, then they would have been in court trying to get an injunction, which they didn't. They did try to get an injunction against the skilled trade strike, and the state tossed that right out because it had no merit. Our strike was lawful and protected.
Cashiers and cooks led protests in more than two dozen cities Wednesday against fast food CEO Andy Puzder's nomination as U.S. Secretary of Labor. The protests at Carl's Jr. and Hardee's stores asserted that Puzder represents the worst of the rigged economy Donald Trump pledged to take on as president. The workers protesting Puzder say if he is labor secretary, it will mean years of continuing low pay, wage theft, sexual harassment, and racial discrimination instead of making the lives of workers better.
Brought to you in part by the Alliance for American Manufacturing, working to build coalitions between business, labor, legislators, and activists. Information about our mission to strengthen American manufacturing and rebuild the middle class through smart public policy is available online at AmericanManufacturing.org.
WIN is brought to you in part by the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest labor union representing transit and allied workers in the U.S. and Canada. Online at ATU.org.
laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The deep seas are some of the most uncharted ecosystems in the world. Scientists say we know more about the surface of the moon. Yet the world's first commercial deep sea mining operation for gold, copper, and silver in the Bismarck Sea could be underway in just a year. But locals in Papua New Guinea are considering a lawsuit, calling for greater transparency and fearing the project could cause irreversible damage to one of the world's few pristine frontiers. Georgia Clark with Free Speech Radio News has more from Papua New Guinea.
In the next 100 years, humankind is set to face ever more pressing environmental challenges. With climate change already taking hold, scientists say conservation is crucial. But economies with growing populations continue to depend on finite resources, like fossil fuels and minerals, pushing exploration for deposits into new frontiers. And that quest for resources has come to an underwater biosphere off the coast of Papua New Guinea's New Island province.
These deep sea hydrothermal vents are the most remarkable biological communities ever discovered, and they were only very recently discovered in the 1970s.
Marine biologist Professor Richard Steiner has been studying the area and the life it sustains.
The rarity of this ecosystem is extraordinary. It could be the most rare ecosystem type in the biosphere of this planet.
Canadian mining company Nautilus Minerals has been developing a plan to extract high-grade deposits of copper, gold, zinc, and silver on the seabed near the mineral-rich underwater hydrothermal vent systems. According to their environmental impact statement, remote-controlled seafloor mining devices would collect ore that will be sent to the surface for processing. Known as the Solwara 1 project, the 25-acre underwater site is slated to become the world's first commercial seabed mine. But the project has been under fire, with critics arguing that the environmental risks are too high and more recently calling on Nautilus to be more transparent. Natalie Lowry is media coordinator at the Deep Sea Mining Campaign.
For the past 4 years, the Deep Sea Mining Campaign and also communities in Papua New Guinea have been calling on the government and Nautilus to release documents around this project. If they don't, I guess, you know, there could be a situation where communities there look at a legal challenge.
Some Papua New Guinea locals have raised concerns about the government's 15% stake in the project. John Chitoa is a coordinator with Bismarck Ramu, an NGO that represents Papuans opposed to the project.
The PNG government is so corrupt that it's very difficult to monitor and regulate projects like this. Given the situation, it is a stakeholder in the Solar One project. Therefore, there will be conflict of interest, and we don't think it will carry out its responsibility of regulating and monitoring this project effectively. To make matters worse, the conservation minister was formerly the mining minister. He was the one that licensed Nautilus. So basically, you see that it is the same person that gave mining license to Nautilus Minerals, and now it is the same person that's supposed to be protecting the people and the environment.
Chitoa says indigenous communities in PNG also worry about how mining operations could disrupt long-standing cultural practices closely linked to the local environment.
The sea is their welfare and their livelihood. It's the source of food. People in New Island, they also use the sea for daily bathing, cooking. In the past, the people used to use the sea as their graveyard as well. In west coast of New Island, they still practice shark calling.
FSRN sent multiple interview requests to Nautilus Minerals over a 3-week period. A company representative said Nautilus CEO Mike Johnston would be unavailable for comment until after the story's publication. In past statements, Nautilus Minerals has expressed confidence that cutting-edge technology will allow the company to mine the seabed in an environmentally responsible way. But Professor Steiner, who conducted his own independent study into the proposed mine, says the project warrants extreme caution.
Scientifically, there's just too many unknowns about these deep sea vent communities. So we really can't accurately predict what the impacts will be, but we do know that they will be severe on a local scale, and they could actually be severe and long-lasting. There could be species extinctions caused just on this 11-hectare site.
While some environmentalists argue there is insufficient conclusive evidence to give the world's first commercial deep-sea mine the green light, Nautilus argues the benefits of deep-sea mines outweigh those of terrestrial mines. Professor Elaine Baker is an expert in the sustainable use of marine resources at the University of Sydney.
I think the one thing Nautilus has done well is they've been very good on collecting scientific information. They've been very open about what they've found in terms of the biodiversity. They've engaged top scientists from around the world to do the environmental impact study, and they've taken note of criticism. They've really progressed the science and our understanding of these organisms by the number of studies that they've done.
Copper density in the Solwara deposit is reputedly several times higher than what is typical in terrestrial mines. It's copper that Nautilus says will help meet worldwide demand for goods like smartphones and computers. Natalie Lowry of the Deep Sea Mining Campaign says consumers need to consider costs behind the price tag.
Solwara 1 is gold and copper. We don't really need any more gold. Gold, 80% of gold is used for jewellery. It's not a necessity. Copper, yes. I mean, you know, I can understand that copper is used in a lot of things, but these are things that could be recycled. We could really look at the idea of urban mining and circular economy is actually cradle to cradle. So actually the way we design our products in the first place, that they can last longer, but also we're able to extract the minerals and metals from there is the best way possible.
While Nautilus has outlined mitigation strategies such as transplanting sea animals in the path of the mines, with the integrity of their sea life and cultural practices at stake, locals say court action is foreseeable. With operations set to commence in 2018, the clock is ticking. Georgia Clark, FSRN.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Laura Klinkner, Grace Ann Smith, and Jenka Soderberg. The producer is myself, Sam Bowman. Special thanks to Ray Bodwell and to our friends at Free Speech Radio News. You can find daily content at fsrn.org. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Charity Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn welcome your calls on Positively Revolting. At 9, on Beloved Community, interviews with three activists who have fought for social change. Ibrahim Mubarak, Joanne Hardesty, and Teresa Rayford talk about the state of Martin Luther King's dream. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. And at 11, on Digital Divide, we'll hear portions of a recent interview with NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
After a 9-hour confirmation hearing yesterday, a decision was postponed on whether to make longtime ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson the next Secretary of State. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with energy analyst Antonia Juhas.
We are joined on the line now by Antonia Juhas, who is an energy analyst and an author, and recently wrote the piece for In These Times, Rex Tillerson could be America's most dangerous Secretary of State. Antonia, could you first start us off with what is the status of Rex Tillerson's nomination? He had a hearing yesterday with the Senate. How close is he to actually becoming the next Secretary of State?
Well, Senator Merkley is one of the first senators to say that he will not be voting for Rex Tillerson, and he was quite active in Tillerson's hearing yesterday, asking very good questions. It was 9 hours for the hearing. There was supposed to be a second day today, and it was canceled. And I think the reason for that is because, you know, the Senate committee, I believe, expected to see a candidate for Secretary of State show up, and instead who they saw was the CEO of ExxonMobil. And basically, Rex Tillerson answered questions the way he would as a CEO serving his company, not a man poised to represent the public good. And he did not come off well, and so they pulled the second day of the hearing, I would guess, to do damage control. And so, every single Democrat in the committee would need to vote against Tillerson and be joined by at least one Republican. Marco Rubio appears very likely to possibly be that Republican. However, there is a move that they can make in that committee to essentially just skip the vote and send the nomination straight to the Senate floor, in which case every Democrat and three Republicans would need to oppose Tillerson. You know, I think there's a possibility. I think he did not do a good job. I think it's, you know, basically he's a shocking nominee, which is why I wrote that article. And I think, you know, if there are many nominees who should not be appointed into this cabinet, and he is, you know, high, if not the top of my list for people who are just not qualified for the cabinet positions they've been nominated to.
He is the CEO of ExxonMobil, which at the same time as he has been preparing for his testimony to become Secretary of State, is also facing a coming trial. And I wonder if you could talk